Ladies and gentlemen, we are now beginning the conference call. If you get disconnected during the call, please call 1-888-409-6709. Again, the number to get reconnected is 1-888-409-6709. At this time, your line is muted and will continue to remain muted during the duration of the call. To ask a question or if you have a comment, please press star 1. If at any time during the conference you need assistance, please press star 0. I would now like to introduce Meredith Dodson, Director of U.S. Poverty Campaigns of Results, Inc., located in Washington, D.C., to open the call.
Great. Thank you, operator, and hello, everyone. Happy Father's Day weekend to all those dads out there. So this is Meredith Dodson. I'm the Director of Results U.S. Poverty Campaign Work, and I'm based in Washington, D.C. A special welcome to anyone joining us for the first time on our national conference call, really thrilled also to have a fabulous guest speaker on our call today. So as a quick announcement, you can download the conference call slides from the Results homepage at results.org. Also on our Facebook page at facebook.com/resultsedfund. I just want to especially say to all of those of you that are coming to Washington, D.C. for our international conference next week, really thrilled to be seeing you in person. So I'm going to keep this opening short because we do have a great speaker and I want to get right to it. So just to walk quickly through the agenda for the call, we have Dr. Maya Rockymore on the line from the Center for Global Policy Solutions here in Washington, D.C. So we will have a rich conversation about, so we can understand better, the racial wealth gap. After that, I'll do a quick campaign or legislative update about what's been happening specifically with some tax policy developments here in Washington. And then our national grassroots manager, Joss Lynn, will walk us through actions we can take to mobilize others, and we'll do some training on that and with some help from our U.S. Poverty Campaign Organizer, Expansion Organizer, Christy Martino, based on up in Maine. We'll also get a quick training on using social media and hear from Cricket Nikovich, our Senior Policy Associate for Global Poverty Campaigns. So that way folks have a little bit of context, especially for joint lobby meetings on Capitol Hill during our conference. We'll hear a couple of shares, some cool things that have been happening locally. We'll have a roll call where folks will think about how many folks they're going to ask to write letters and call Congress for a national call-in day, and then we'll close out the call with some announcements. So that's the agenda for our call today. And now let me go to introducing our guest speaker. So Dr. Maya Rockymore is the president and CEO of the Center for Global Policy Solutions, which is a social change strategy firm dedicated to making policy work for people and their environments. She's the author of a recent report, which is why we wanted to bring her on the call today, because we're so excited that this research is happening. She's the co-author of Beyond Broke, Why Closing the Racial Wealth Gap is a Priority for National Economic Security. She's worked at American University, the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, the National Urban League, for Representative Charles Rangel, and as professional staff for the House Ways and Means Committee. And Dr. Rockymore has a degree, undergraduate degree from Prairie View A&M University in Texas, and then a master's and PhD from Purdue. So one of the more impressive folks out there, especially looking at the racial wealth gap. And Dr. Rockymore, I'll just flag that this, you being on this month's call, is the direct result of Representative Barbara Lee on our last month call talking about how important the work that you all were doing, kind of emphasizing that we needed to check that out, which we already had. And both she and I were really impressed by the event, the racial wealth gap event in the Capitol Visitor Center about 6 weeks ago. So you come highly recommended from a member of Congress, which is always a good way to start off our conference call here, given the kind of network that we have on the phone today. So with that, what I'd like to do is actually ask you to make some opening remarks, and then we'll go to some questions after that. So go ahead.
So thank you, Meredith, for the invitation. Thanks to every single person who's on the phone today, spending their Saturday on a subject, speaking about a subject that's so very important, not just for the United States of America, but certainly for the world. And so I did hear that you're global in scope, and I'm excited to hear that. And also, I want to thank Barbara Lee, even though she isn't on the phone. We consider her one of the champions on this issue, and she is a stalwart, not just on the issue of certainly the racial wealth gap, but on poverty in general. And so just know that I am very pleased to be here today talking to you about the racial wealth gap. We've been hearing so much about income and economic inequality, but the fact of the matter is that nobody has been talking about the racialized aspects of inequality. And here in the United States, and actually also around the world, there is a color of wealth. And in the United States, the color of wealth is actually white. We are now 50 years beyond the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and what we see is that although African Americans, Latinos, Asian Pacific Americans, and other people of color are allowed to, walk in the doors, the front doors of restaurants, and to go to various schools that used to be whites only. When it comes to the racial wealth gap, we still see a very, very stark contrast. And so several of my colleagues and I decided to write a report, and that report is codified in the presentation that we'll be talking to today. But before I get to that, we are a part of an Experts of Color Network. It's a Ford Foundation-funded initiative of more than 180 academics, advocates, and practitioners from across the United States who focus on economic disparities and looking at how to use asset building as a tool to build wealth in communities of color, specifically low-income communities across the board generically. And with that, we did the report Beyond Broke, and it focuses on not income inequality, but wealth inequality. And we know that the difference between wealth and income is an important one to make. Income is a part of wealth, but wealth also includes other assets that you might own. So overall, what you own minus what you owe is what wealth is. And it's important that we consider wealth because having other assets outside of income provides the stability that many families need in tough economic times. And it's also an intergenerational stepping stone to prosperity. So just think about, when you think about wealth, inheriting wealth, whether that's a home or a business or savings, money and savings, is important to help families get through tough times, and certainly passing wealth on through generations helps subsequent generations get a leg up in life. And unfortunately, we know that discriminatory policies and practices have played a significant role in creating wealth differentials between racial and ethnic groups. Oftentimes, when you talk about inequality in this nation, people want to talk about individual and personal responsibility without understanding that structural factors have actually created patterns of disparities. Opportunity and the lack of opportunity, and it's been systematic. And this data that I'm about to show you will actually highlight that. And so for those of you who do have slides in front of you, the figure one shows that that we have a liquid wealth gap by race and ethnicity. This is data taken from the U.S. Census Survey of Income and Program Participation. It's the latest data of 2011. And it shows that when you're looking at liquid wealth, and that is the amount of wealth that people hold in cash or assets that can readily transfer into cash, you see that whites have a liquid wealth of $23,000. Asian Americans have a liquid wealth amount of $19,500. Latinos have a liquid wealth of $340. And African Americans have a liquid wealth of $200. This is not $200,000, this is $200. And when you take retirement income out of that liquid wealth estimate, African Americans have only $25 compared to a liquid wealth of $3,000 for whites. And this is a median number right here. The next slide is the share of households with no tangible or financial assets by race and ethnicity. And you see that African Americans, over a third of African Americans and Latinos, have no tangible, no financial assets whatsoever, meaning that these households are literally, they have a zero wealth or they have negative wealth. And this is why we entitled the paper, the report, Beyond Broke, because literally these families are in desperate poverty. They have no assets, and many of them are in debt. And the next slide just shows you what we mean by tangible assets versus financial assets. So tangible assets as, you know, owning a car or a home or any other motor vehicle or any other tangible asset that you can touch. And then financial assets includes, you know, your checking account or your retirement account. And we see on this slide that when it comes to financial assets, there the disparity that I mentioned previously is just very stark. And when it comes to retirement accounts, it's incredible. Only 28% of Latinos have a financial asset in a retirement account. Only 32% of African Americans have a financial asset that sets that is represented into a in a retirement account, compared to 58% of whites and 57% of Asian Americans. That's important to point out. However, we see that, you know, overall, and the reason why I'm pointing to retirement accounts is because we have a greater retirement crisis in our nation. It's a crisis that affects many Americans, regardless of race or ethnicity, but it specifically and dramatically affects African Americans and Latinos. And so we wanted to point that out. There are also significant disparities in checking account access, with only 55% of African Americans owning a checking account, 60% of Latinos, compared to 80% and 83% of whites and Asians, respectively. And so the next slide actually shows you some dramatic things. We've been hearing, and it's been erroneous, that you know, the Federal Reserve data, you'll hear like blaring from the pages of the Wall Street Journal or in some of the other news outlets, that Americans have fully recovered all of the wealth that they lost as a result of the Great Recession. Well, that is actually not true. In fact, none of these outlets are actually pointing to the fact that when you look at the net worth of families by race and ethnicity, you see that African Americans, Asian Americans, and Latinos actually experienced a dramatic loss in their net worth. For those who managed to have some wealth, they experienced more than half of them, more than half of African American, actually, of African Americans, Asian Americans, and Latinos lost more than half of their net worth as a result of the Great Recession. And so the first circle that you see up top shows that between 2005 and 2009, Latinos lost 65% of their net worth. Asians lost 54% of their net worth in 2009, by 2009, and African Americans lost 53% of their net worth. Now, that's compared to only 16% loss for whites, showing you that blacks, Latinos, and Asian Americans really experienced a significant loss that they have not recovered from, by the way. So the next circle that you see, that 2009 to 2011 figure, shows that while African Americans, Asian Americans, and Latinos actually recovered some of that, they still are not out of the deep hole that they actually experienced as a result of the Great Recession. Now, whites, interestingly enough, in 2011 experienced a 6% an additional 6% loss in their net worth, and so that's very interesting indeed. Now, the circle right below that is actually the headline news from this study. And that shows that for every $1 in wealth held by the typical white family, the typical African American family has only 6 cents, and the typical Latino family has only 7 cents. Now, these are median net worth numbers, but it shows you the disparity that exists. It's the dramatic illustration of the disparity that continues to exist more than 50 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Now, interestingly enough, you'll see that Asian Americans actually had higher net worth than whites did prior to 2005. By 2011, their net worth was 80 cents on every dollar of wealth held by the typical 83 cents on every dollar of wealth held by the typical white family. So, they did experience a significant drop, but their disparities are not as nearly as high as they are for African Americans and Latinos. But we should say that for Asian Americans, there are subgroups in the Asian American community who are doing very, very badly. And they're, like the Hmong, these groups are actually hidden. Their poverty is hidden because there are some Asian subgroups that are doing extremely well. All right, and so the question might be, why? Why is it that people of color have experienced a dramatically higher rate of net worth loss as a result of the Great Recession? And the answer lies in the housing market. You see that that we have the median equity and the ownership in homes. As of 2011, you saw that Asian Americans and Latinos experienced a dramatic change, a loss in the value of their homes between 2005 and 2011, with African Americans and whites being a little bit lower in terms of their losses that they had in their equity. And this is why you see that Asian Americans and Latinos tended to live, or they were more heavily concentrated in the states where there was a dramatic housing crisis. So California, Arizona, Florida, they had a higher presence in those states, and so the value of their homes dropped dramatically because they were heavily concentrated in those states that really had a tough time with regards to the twin contributions of the housing crisis, the subprime mortgage crisis, and the related recession, Great Recession. And so with that, because of their heavy concentration in these states, they really took a hit in the chin. I should also say that these families, Asian American, Latino, and African American families, were also heavily targeted by subprime mortgage lenders. We're struggling with unsustainable mortgages on top of that. The next slide shows the number of families, the percentage of families who are underwater. And you see that that African Americans, 25% of African Americans are underwater on their mortgages compared to, and 28% of Latinos, 28% of Latinos and African Americans are underwater on their mortgages compared to 15% of whites. And that just shows you the combined effects of the subprime crisis as well as the recession, which saw that African Americans and Latinos had higher unemployment rates, meaning that they were not only did they have unsustainable mortgages, but they were less likely to be able to cover those mortgages when they lost their jobs as a result of the recession. Something that that we should also understand is that, that there is a disparity, a racial disparity in median net worth regardless of income. So people tend to think that, that all low income, if you're low income, you're low income. But the fact of the matter is that even when you look at income levels by quartile, the racial wealth gap exists even at the lowest levels of income. And this is counterintuitive to many people, but this slide that I'm showing you right now shows that that first column, the less than 1,540, So that's the lowest income quintile there is, and that even at that income quartile, that Latinos only have 7% of the wealth of whites in the lowest income quartile, and African Americans have 0% of the wealth of whites at the lowest income quartile. This is an illustration, and it goes up. So, you know, the next income quartile, you see that the racial wealth disparities continue to exist. They continue to exist at every income quartile there is. And that is the basis of our argument that we need to stop thinking about income as the measure of how we look at families and how we develop public policy. Because if we actually are interested in closing the racial wealth gap, we actually have to look at measures beyond income. We have to look at wealth overall. And so with that, you know, some folks want to understand that the racial wealth gap actually exists by gender and race as well. And so, you know, white women tend to do better than, while they still drag behind white men dramatically, they do better than Hispanic women and African American women as well. So where do we go from here? We have a dramatic racial wealth gap that is significant in our nation. As I mentioned, for every dollar in wealth held by the typical white family, Latinos and African Americans only have 6 and 7 cents respectively. It also cuts by gender. And so where do we go? We have basically this notion that we need to be building assets and using asset building as a strategy for addressing poverty. And so this graphic that I'm showing you right now is what we call an asset house. It is our theory of how we build, address poverty and build wealth in low income and low wealth households. And we need to look at this as tiers. So this asset house shows you that at the level of the foundation, there are assets that we all enjoy as a society that many people need. And these assets include things like Social Security and Medicare, social insurance programs, unemployment and wage protection insurance. These are assets that are important for households and also for the stability of our society overall. Quality public education is a part of that. And citizenship is also a part of that. You know, people who are citizens of the United States tend to take citizenship for granted. But for those who don't have citizenship, they know how important that asset is for financial stability. And we need to be thinking about citizenship as a societal asset that people need to support their economic security. The first level of the house are the asset-building policies that we need to put into place. Currently, we have a tax structure that works better for upper-income people in this country, higher net worth people who are already wealthy. But we need to make our tax structure progressive in this society, in this nation. We need to make sure that our education policies and incentives are progressive. We've done a step forward with regards to the Affordable Care Act. We need to do more. We need to have more prevention health programs and incentives. We need to make sure that our safety net programs and incentives are progressive and that our community development programs and incentives are there, that we have employment policies and incentives that are progressive, that actually get at this issue of wealth disparities and really kind of, flips the script in terms of how we're viewing asset building for lower income and low wealth households across the nation. The second floor of the asset house looks at community assets. These are assets that we don't think about, but they're important for the financial security of families of color and actually all families, regardless of race or ethnicity. And that includes assets like kinship networks and culture and community nonprofits, faith-based institutions. And then at the top of the house, you know, when people think about asset building and wealth, they usually just think about the top of the house, which is, you know, how much stock do you own? Do you own a business? Do you have a checking account? Is there money in it? Do you have a retirement fund? Do you have stocks, bonds, and mutual funds? Well, we actually argue that all of those individual assets are actually built on top of other layers. The foundation, the first floor, and the second floor really need to be strong and solid and in place in order to allow individual asset accumulation to occur. That means that we need to be thinking about asset building not just as a private concern, but as a public concern as well. So asset building is public and private, and we need to think about it that way. And so what do we recommend? Better and more jobs, fair financial services. We recommend improving housing policy, expanding entrepreneurship. We recommend investing more in kids and making tax policy fair. And we also recommend retirement security for all. I don't know if many of you know that only 50% of our nation's workforce actually has access to a tax-preferred retirement vehicle offered through their employer. The rest of the nation, if they're, you know, has access to nothing except for Social Security. And so we think that retirement security for all means expanding Social Security and making it not only making sure that it's financially solvent for the foreseeable future, but that it's also strengthened and expanded to actually support people who rely on it for all or almost all of their retirement needs. And then we also call for targeting new investments to low-wealth households. Notice that we don't say income, we say low-wealth. And so, you know, we say that we need to focus on targeted measures. And one measure, one approach to this is what the Congressional Black Caucus calls the 10-20-30 plan, targeting 10% of new federal investments towards the 20% of the population that has lived in poverty for more than 30 years in this nation. And then we also embrace a concept called targeted universalism. And that is that when you got to craft universal policies, there are levers within that policy that you can actually pull to target resources towards low-wealth communities. And there are a number of ways to do that. And so with that, I encourage you to visit us at our website, the Center for Global Policy Solutions, which is www.globalpolicysolutions.org. You can actually see the videos from our recent Color of Wealth Summit there, and you can also view the full report as well as other important information at that website. So with that, Meredith, I welcome questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Rocky Moore. That was fabulous. And again, I really urge folks, if you didn't get a chance to get the PowerPoint in front of you ahead of time, it's available at results.org and also on our Facebook page, and it's definitely worth looking at these figures again, even if you got to see them while we were going through. I think if you have time, maybe we'll take one question from the audience.
Yeah.
If you have a question, please press star one.
You have a question from Minneapolis.
Oh, yes.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Nancy.
Nancy? I think she's on mute.
One question, so knowing that Nancy Polonia is one of our, I think if I recognized her voice there for a moment that we might have lost her, she's one of the folks in our grassroots network who is Native American. So I have no idea if this is what she was going to ask about, but is there, can you talk about anything relating to the racial wealth gap in Native Americans?
Yeah, so as you well know, the census statistics don't actually cover the Native Americans. However, we do know from different studies that Native American asset wealth position is extremely low. They are amongst the African American and Latinos with regards to wealth disparities, and they're doing very badly. You know, groups like the National Congress of American Indians, First Peoples Worldwide, and others have been prioritizing asset building as a strategy for building wealth in Native communities as well. And we fully endorse it, and we work with them, and they're a part of our Closing the Racial Wealth Gap initiative. And we have folks like Rebecca Adamson and others who are a part of that network. So, yes, it's very important.
Great. And if we have Nancy back, Nancy, if that wasn't your question, feel free to ask another.
You do have a question from Chicago.
Okay, Chicago, go ahead.
I was just at a rally in Oak Park where Senator Durbin talked about Patriot corporations, and I was thinking that in addition to, helping corporations to recognize just the need to not put, jobs overseas and so forth, it would be really important for corporations to recognize the needs of minority Americans and those asset wealth building kinds of things that you were talking about. He's talking about creating a bill and calling it something related to Patriot corporations so that, corporations are paying attention to the needs of communities for work and, cutting into the whole issue of corporate tax cuts. You know, he wants to use to penalize companies that are sending, jobs overseas and so forth. So anyway, I think what you were saying about building assets among minorities really fits into mm-hmm. that concept in some way.
Yeah, I think that what he's tapping into is this notion of responsive capitalism, and
right.
that is actually what we all need to be pushing for, because the idea is that, corporations have a huge role here, and to the extent that they do not invest in or have deliberate strategies for making sure that their hiring practices and policies actually support job creation in communities that have been marginalized, then what we see is the continued marginalization of these populations. Government can't be the only employer. And so, the fact of the matter is that companies have a huge role to play here, not just as employers, but also in terms of minority suppliers, investing in women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, et cetera, helping to catalyze wealth creation through their investments in these communities, helping to invest in them in terms of their education systems and other things. Companies have a huge amount of wealth, as you well know, and how they choose to use that wealth matters for closing, addressing poverty and closing the racial wealth gap specifically. Now, the issue about focusing just on U.S. companies and making sure that they repatriate jobs here is important, but we have to realize that the cat's already out of the bag when it comes to globalization. And many of these companies are multinational in scope, and they're operating in countries around the world where we have poverty regardless. And so for corporations, I think responsive capitalism needs to be looking at how you make those investments for marginalized communities wherever they reside in the world. If you're operating in a country, likely there are issues of poverty and discrimination in those countries, and you need to have policies that actually speak to investing in these populations regardless of where you're operating.
Great. Thanks so much
for your
Dr.
incredible research and dynamic slides.
Thank you so much,
and thanks everyone for kind of grappling with this and following along. Dr. Rocky Morris, please know we're just thrilled that you're doing the work that you do, and since we'll be meeting with hundreds of congressional offices in a week and a half to talk about the importance of fair tax policy and investing to make sure folks have a shot at economic mobility. This has been incredibly helpful to provide.
Oh. Well, good luck to everybody, and thank you again. Take care.
Great. So just as a quick update on where we stand with our campaign work, building on this last section, as I think folks know, the House of Representatives and also the Senate is moving forward with some tax legislation. We don't anticipate any final decisions to be made until after the election. So ultimately, while the House of Representatives is passing various tax packages that are really, in many cases, giveaways in the form of hundreds of billions of dollars for primarily for corporations. There won't be any kind of final negotiated legislation to deal with these corporate tax extenders or anything else until the lame duck session. But it's critically important that we raise the importance of, for instance, protecting and expanding the earned income tax credit and child tax credit, of supporting asset building for millions of low-income Americans, and talking about wealth inequality, including the racial wealth gap. We need to be talking about that now, because it'll be fast and furious after the elections, and the kind of grandstanding that happens now and the public, the way that the public is engaged, will be critical in kind of shaping the debate later on, both the rest at the end of this year and beyond. So in a moment, Joss is going to lead a section where we talk through how to engage other folks in our community. So this is in particular a really important time to push Congress to expand economic mobility. Many Results volunteers, as you know, are traveling to D.C. next week for our international conference, but we can all support them and back them up by reinforcing the message through letters and calls, et cetera. So with that, we'll go to Joss for a chance to walk through some of the specific steps we can take to engage others in our communities. Joss?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, folks. This is Jocelyn, the grassroots manager for U.S. Poverty Campaigns. And if you're following along in the PowerPoint, we're on slide number 24. And so I'm excited to talk about the action this month, which is about mobilizing our communities into action around the Results International Conference. And we know a lot of folks can't make it to D.C., and so we want to make sure that, you know, people back home can still participate in the experience, as well as get other people in your community ready to go. So I'm going to just kind of run through what you can do there in your communities to mobilize people to get involved. So I'll just run through these very quickly. You know, first, obviously, you want to identify who you want to reach out to, friends, colleagues, people online, things like that, and reach out to them and ask them to take action. And we urge you to do that now, and I'll talk in a minute about specific actions you can take, especially when during the conference, but start doing that now if you haven't done it already. Second, when you're reaching out to people, try to reach out to them individually and personally if you had the opportunity, because that's going to be they're more likely to respond positively that way. And you want to tell them what's at stake, so you can share some of the information that Dr. Rocky Moore talked about or what Merritt just mentioned, just to kind of show, you know, when people think, okay, something urgent is coming up or something important is happening right now, they're more likely to take action. So make taking action seem urgent for them. And then you want to give them, and I'm on slide 25 now, you want to give them something specific they can do. And we actually have two ideas that we want you to think about this week. For those people who are coming to D.C. next week, gather letters in your community and bring them with you. Hand deliver your letters to your members of Congress during your lobby meetings. So today, you know, in your groups, as you're listening to the call, when you finish, take some time and write some letters to both your senators and your representative, and then have the person in your group coming to D.C. bring those letters with them. If you know other people in your community would be willing to write letters, have them do that as well and collect them before your group member comes to D.C. If you don't have anybody in your group that's coming to D.C., then send your letters to maybe a neighboring group, another group in your state that has somebody going. Mail them out there so that they can go, so that they can take them with them. And page two of the June action, which is linked to there in the PowerPoint, is designed specifically for this. It has talking points for letters as well as a sample letter you can use. Another thing that you could do June 24th is lobby day at the conference, when hundreds of advocates will be up on Capitol Hill lobbying their members of Congress. Well, we want to use this as an opportunity to magnify that voice with a national call-in day. So we're urging people that are back home, as well as other people in your community, to call in that day, reiterating the same message that people will be saying in their meetings. You know, think about how cool it would sound to know that, you know, you have advocates sitting down with their members of Congress talking about these issues, and out in the lobby, the receptionist is fielding dozens of calls with the exact same message. So we actually have a call-in flyer you can download, and it has, you know, the number to call and what to say when you call. It has a link to email action you can do, so you could call and then hang up after you've done your calls and send an email. And use that flyer not only to call yourself, but to send out to people in your community to take action as well. Then another thing that you can do is use social media to help get the word out, and Meredith's actually going to do a training on that in just a second, so I'll kind of skip over that because she'll cover that. And then finally, what you can do is share your experience. So if you're coming to the conference, you know, plan when you get back to share your experience with people back home, you know, and maybe have a potluck or dinner with friends or a community meeting or something like that where you can invite people and come and tell them about your experience in D.C., what you did, what your live meetings were like, you know, about delivering their letters and things like that, so that they can get feel the experience and maybe get motivated to actually take action and come to the conference next year. So with that, we talked about the call-in day. We're going to briefly do a very quick training on what it's like to do a call-in day. They're pretty easy, but we've got Christy Martino from our U.S. Poverty Organizer from the Northeast is going to run through the training for us. Christy, are you there?
I am. Hi, everybody. So I have the pleasure of doing our speaking training this month, and as Josh mentioned, we're wanting to generate lots of calls to Congress on June 24th. Talking about expanding economic mobility in America. This is really a great way for those of you who cannot come to D.C. to be a part of this year's conference, as well as a quick and easy way to get others to take action. If you've never called Congress on a call-in day, it's really easy to do. You're basically calling the receptionist and then giving your name and where you're calling from and leaving your message. The people who answer the phones at your House and Senate offices keep track of these calls and what people are saying, and they provide a report to them to your members of Congress, so they do matter. So for this month's training, we're going to role play one of these calls, and I'm happy to have Dylan Hague from our Seacoast group to play the operator and receptionist for me. So let's imagine it's June 24th, and I've just dialed the Capitol switchboard at 202-224-3121. Ring, ring.
Capitol switchboard.
Would you please connect me with Senator Collins' office, please?
Hold, please. Senator Collins' office.
Yes, hi, my name is Christy Martino, and I'm a constituent from Kittery Point, Maine. I'm very concerned that Congress is not doing enough for working Americans. The Earned Income Tax Credit and Child Tax Credit lift more children out of poverty than any other program. Also, the Financial Security Credit would help low-income Americans save and avoid being just one financial emergency away from poverty. Please put working Americans first. Will you tell Senator Collins to urge tax leaders to protect and expand the EITC and the Child Tax Credit and to pass the Financial Security Credit into law?
Yes, I'll give her the message. Thank you for your call.
Okay, so I would then call back two more times for my other senator and for my representative, and it's that easy. It should really take you no more than a few minutes to make all three calls. So now everybody pair up in your groups, and we'll take 2 minutes to practice. One person play the receptionist and the other play the volunteer, and then you guys can switch. Operator, we'll go silent now, and I will be back in 2 minutes. right, guys. Thank you all for doing that. Hopefully that exercise showed you just how easy doing a call-in is. Please send out our call-in flyer far and wide and urge people to call in on the 24th. The more calls we generate, the bigger impact we'll make. We'll also send out an email the morning of June 24th urging people to call, which you can forward to people as a reminder. Thank you all and good luck. Now let's go to Meredith to talk about using social media during the international conference.
Great. So for everyone, actually, the social media aspect is twofold. There's, of course, an opportunity to use social media during our international conference. I really urge those of you who are going to be in Washington, D.C., to share about that as it happens on Facebook or on Twitter, share pictures of you on Capitol Hill, et cetera. But then also all of us with a Facebook account or Twitter account or whatever else you've got going on there can post a short message, and we've got an example in our PowerPoint urging folks to take action. And one of the things we'll promise to do is if you go to the results Facebook page, so if you go to facebook.com/resultsedfunds, hopefully you've liked us already, but if not, please do that. And you'll have something you can hit share on. If you hit that share button, all your friends and family will see a post and then add a personal comment urging folks to call. And then the second part is making sure that they let you know that they've done so. So if you look on our PowerPoint slide, you can see information on that and also how to use Twitter. So that's on slide 28. And with that, we're going to go to the share section of our call. And I think, oh, no, sorry, we're going next to my colleague, Cricket Nikovich, to do a quick update on what those of you who are going to be in D.C. and joint lobby visits will be learning about based on the fabulous work of our global poverty focus groups. Cricket, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Meredith. Hi, everyone. I'm so excited to see everyone at the international conference. And for those of you who are not coming, we'll also be doing some sort of action take with our global groups as well, so you can take action with them at home while you're doing your domestic work if you're not able to come to the conference. But I wanted to give you an update on what our major buckets of work will be at the international conference. We really have two primary asks. The first will be following up on our appropriations work that we've been doing since January. You know, the global groups have been working on fully funding foreign aid around specific issues through what's called the State and Foreign Operations Appropriations Bill. One of those, both the House and the Senate subcommittee markups are scheduled for next week on those bills. And so we'll be following up with offices, hoping it may actually still be in play during the conference on the House side, but most likely the appropriations work will be finished before folks come to the conference on the Senate side. But we've really been focusing our appropriations work around, one, the Global Partnership for Education, Access to Basic Education, two, bilateral tuberculosis control and ensuring folks have access to treatment and prevention and particularly focusing on drug-resistant tuberculosis, and also, lastly, the Maternal and Child Health Account, which also funds the work of Gavi, the Global Vaccines Fund. The Maternal Child Health Account is going to be something that's really critical this year, especially as we're looking at a conference as a launching point, and this is our second big bucket of work around Gavi. So we'll have appropriations and Gavi being the two main buckets of work at the conference. And the Gavi Alliance is the Global Vaccines Fund, and this conference really will be our kickoff campaign for the next 6 to 8 months around working to fully fund Gavi at their upcoming replenishment conference, which has recently been scheduled for next year in Germany, early next year. Also during our conference it's the two-year anniversary of the maternal, the Child Survival Call to Action. And that anniversary, 2 years ago in 2012, it's actually when the U.S. came forward with the goal of ending preventable child deaths by the year 2035. And a lot of our work at the conference with Raj Shah, the head of USAID, and Seth Berkley, the head of Gavi Alliance, will be focused around maternal child health and Gavi and fully supporting Gavi in this next replenishment cycle in which they Gavi says if they're fully funded in the next five-year period, 2016 to 2020, in fact, we'll be able to immunize 300 million children, saving 5 to 6 million lives. So it's a great opportunity to get educated on those issues, but also to take that message to the Hill about how we can be a part of ending preventable child deaths and how Gavi plays a huge role in that.
Great. Thanks, Cricket. And with that, we're going to go to the share section. Should we just go straight to Kemp Spalding in Charlottesville? Kemp, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, go ahead. Tell us about your recent town hall.
Okay. Well, Lisa, my partner, is the one who got a notice that Senator Warner, who, if people remember, was the leader of the Gang of Six, he's on the Finance Committee. He started his campaign, so he's coming down here. So we said, yeah, let's go. I don't know what to expect. So we went in, and he talked for about 10 minutes, and then he just opened it up, so it became like a town hall. And I wish I had thrown my arm up first, but I didn't because I was just wasn't ready. And so then I had all these trepidations that he wasn't ever going to call him because everybody started raising their hand. So he said, well, I'll take one more. And he looked over at me and he said, yes, what's your question? And I was like, yeah, all right. So I said, it's my understanding that Congress wants to make final these tax cuts to the corporations, and yet EITC and CTC are kind of being left behind and vulnerable, and I just don't think it's fair. And he said, you're absolutely right, it's not fair. And these are the most important programs that bring people out of poverty that there is, that we have now. And then he went on to say that he thought that the way that this could possibly, that they're bargaining chips. And so it's like a trading action. But it was interesting to see how he thinks about it, how Washington works with it. And I was really glad. I was, you know, standing only 10 feet from him, and he's a very personable guy. And so that's the first meeting that I've ever had with him face-to-face like that. And so it was very exciting.
Yay! Great. And with that, why don't we go to Joss to tell us about the impact of some of the media work that you've been doing in Iowa. Joss, are you there?
Yeah, okay. So, folks, I briefly want to tell you a story about how your media advocacy can really make a difference. And first, you know, we want to thank everyone who took action back in May to get media published. Since May 1, Results Volunteers have gotten 7 letters to the editor and 2 op-eds published as part of the May action, and hopefully we'll have some more over the next few weeks. Now, our local group here in Des Moines, we actually get 2 letters to the editor and 1 op-ed published telling Congress to stop passing tax cuts for corporations and instead help families get an EITC and child tax credit. Now, like Results trained us, we listed our members of Congress by name in our media pieces. In fact, one of the letters was in response to an op-ed one of our Iowa representatives had written supporting the big corporate tax cuts that the House passed back in May. Well, I guess this congressman reads the paper, because when our op-ed ran this past Tuesday, which again named him as well as others who had voted for that tax cut, our group was contacted by 3 different people on the congressman's staff. They pointed out all the things he had done to protect and expand the EITC and child tax credit. And we explained that we appreciate his support for these credits and we consider him an ally, but we want more than that. We want him talking about these issues as prominently as he did in his op-ed about the corporate tax cut. So it's important to remember that even with people we consider friends, we should still push them to do more. And that's the only way we'll create the political will for change. And it was a polite conversation, and what will come of it, I don't know. But it does show that your members of Congress pay attention to these things and that your media does have an impact. So if you haven't sent in your letter to the editor or op-ed about protecting the EITC and child tax credit, it's not too late. You never know who might call you in response. And if you're coming to the International Conference next week, bring your published media with you so that you can show your members of Congress in your lobby meeting. So now let me turn it over to one of our newest results groups, the Results Johnson County Group in Iowa City, Iowa, to Chris Hummerchaus to do our roll call. Chris, are you there?
I'm here.
Yep, go ahead.
Hi, it's Chris Hummerchaus, and as Josh said, we're the new Results Johnson County Group in Iowa City, and I'm pleased to do this month's roll call, and we're scheduled to begin any minute now. here are the questions we want you to answer this month. One, how many people are in the room right now? And two, how many people will you ask to write letters to Congress and to call Congress on June 24th for the National Call-In Day? In a minute, the operator will begin calling your groups by city. When your city is called, simply answer the question like this. Our numbers are 6 and 40. Remember, the operator will unmute your phone when your city is called, so you don't need to do anything to your phone. Again, the questions are, how many people are in the room, and how many people will you ask to write letters and call Congress on June 24th? Okay, operator, we're ready to begin.
Arlington.
For lobby day, and I think this may be more on the global side.
Oh, operator, are you going alphabetical by city name?
Yes.
Okay, and is there, could you quickly shift it to alphabetical by state? Because I think that's what our groups are used to. If you can't, that's fine. We'll go by city.
I apologize. One moment.
And here are the, you know, key points to make.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sometimes.
Ma'am, I apologize. I'm not sure that there's a way to do that.
Okay, great. So heads up, everyone. We're going in a different order. Arlington, I'm assuming that's Arlington, Virginia, will be first.
Yes, Arlington.
Look at the resources. And
what was the question?
Is it over?
Number one is how many folks are in the room? Number two is how many letters and calls you'll be generating on economic mobility and taxes?
Four and two.
Okay, great.
Aurora.
Our numbers are 2 and 200.
Baltimore. Baltimore. Bernardsville.
Did you say Bernardsville?
Yes.
Our numbers are 4 and 50.
Chambersburg?
Our numbers are 1 and 4.
Charlottesville?
2 and 15.
Chicago?
1 and 50.
College Park. College Park. Columbia Falls.
Our numbers are 1 and 20.
Columbus.
Our numbers are 4 and 10.
Coram. Coram.
Hello, our numbers are 1 and 6.
Detroit. Detroit.
Our numbers are 2 and 4.
Iowa City.
Our numbers are 4 and 20.
Kittery Point.
2 and 20.
Lenzburg.
Our numbers are 2 and 4.
Minneapolis.
Our numbers are 6 and 60.
Salina.
Salina is 2 and 8.
San Diego.
San Diego is 6 and 60.
Santa Fe.
Our numbers are 5 and 50.
And Washington, D.C.
Our numbers are 3 and 15. Great. Cynthia, do you have a total?
Yes, I do. We have a total of 52 individuals in the room, and you will have 598 letters to Congress.
Great, thanks. And with that, we're going to close out the call with our final announcements. Jay, are you on the line in there? Do you want to come back to my office real fast? We have a great new intern here in our office named Jay Carroll. But in order for me to take notes, he was in the other room. Jay, are you there? No, we can't hear you. Can you come over here real fast? Okay, so Jay is an intern with us at the United Methodist Church, the Global Board for Church and Society, and he is part of their Ethnic and Adult Internship Program. He'll be going to Washington, D.C. for the first time as a part of our conference. And since he's from North Carolina, he's going to be meeting with our North Carolina members of Congress. So with that, here we go to Jay for a few final announcements.
Okay, hello, everyone. We are looking forward to seeing you all coming to Washington, D.C. next weekend for the Results International Conference. It's going to be a great event, and we only wish all of you could be there. And here are a few items you can do to create a great conference experience, whether you're in D.C. or back home. One of the few items you can do is you can read our U.S. Poverty Campaign's handbook, which will prepare you for the conference, especially your lobby meetings. And even if you're not coming to D.C., it is a great resource for your advocacy back home. Two, you can set up your lobby meeting. If you're coming to D.C., please contact your House and Senate schedules to set up a face-to-face meeting for lobby day, June 24. This is very important. Ask people in your group to help set up meetings if you're having a tough time getting them done. When you get your lobby meeting set up, please enter the meeting information into our lobby meeting form at www.tinyurl.com/hillmeeting. Don't forget to invite your members of Congress to our lobby day reception. Use our invitation letter on the Results International Conference page to invite them to speak at our lobby day reception at the Washington Court Hotel on June 24th. Send us your picture. We want you or your group represented in the opening session slideshow at the conference. After today's call, please take a picture of your group and send it to us. If possible, include a sign that completes this sentence. The change I want to be in the world is. And for example, the change I want to be in the world is economic opportunity for all. Or the change I want to be in the world is making poverty history. Please send this picture to me at jcarroll@results.org no later than this Tuesday, June 17th. Participate in the Everyday Hero Dash virtual race. At the conference, we'll be doing a second annual Everyday Hero Dash on June 21st at 7:30 p.m. outside the conference hotel. You can run, walk, stroll, or dance any distance you want. This is a fundraiser for Results, and you can even participate from back home. All racers will get an Everyday Hero medal. You can register as a racer yourself for $25 at www.tinyurl.com/2014EHD or support someone else who is racing at www.tinyurl.com/resource-race. Now let's do the final announcements. We want to give a shout out to our newest groups in the call today, Results Seacoast, Results Johnston County, Iowa, and Results Spokane. Welcome. Nominate someone for the Grassroots Board. We are looking to fill two Grassroots Board positions this year. If you want to nominate someone from our Grassroots Network to be on the Results Board, please submit your nominations to Jack McLaughlin at jmclaughlin@results.org. The nomination deadline is tomorrow, June 15th. The results U.S. Poverty Free Agents calls will also be meeting this Tuesday, June 17th at 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. If you know someone who might make a great results advocate, please invite them to our results introductory call on Friday, June 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. You can find a full list of upcoming events along with call-in numbers and registration links on the results events calendar. Thank you for being on call today. The next results national conference call is Saturday, July 12th. This will be a joint call with our results global volunteers, so please note the call will begin at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Finally, let's wish all our D.C. travelers a good luck for their meetings on Capitol Hill and wish each other a happy Independence Day.
Safe travels, everyone!
Yay! Happy 4th of July.
Yay! Happy 4th of July.
International Conference.